The cell phone has changed dramatically. Nowadays, it's not so much a phone as a way of life. You can use it to surf the web, check email, stream audio, video, take photos, use GPS. Those functions represent huge technological advances. But when Consumer Reports rated the best and worst of cell phones for its January 2010 issue, we noticed that for one category, not one of the phones achieved an excellent or even a very good. The category? Voice quality, which raises the question, why are such remarkable little devices so bad at being the basic thing that cell phones are, phones? Well, joining us is Michael Gikas, who is Senior Electronics Editor at Consumer Reports. And Michael Gikas, tell us about your findings.
Right. You said it yourself. Cell phones have come a long way in the last few years. They've added so many wonderful features, web browsing, text messaging, social networking applications. They're mini computers. But one area where they haven't improved one bit is in voice quality.
Why is that? If you can listen to music on your cell phone, if you can record voice messages on your cell phone that all seem to have higher fidelity, why can't you hear someone decently when they call you?
Apparently, it's not high on the priority list of the carriers or the phone makers. Voice quality for them, if you can hear the other person at the other end, that's a success. So they end up with adequate service.
You have actually tested all the different cell phones in this category. Are there some that are remarkably better or remarkably worse than the others?
Well, generally speaking, phones that use CDMA technology, that's the phones that use the Verizon and Sprint network, tend to sound a little better than phones that are on AT&T's and T-Mobile's network. But that's not the whole story. There are lots of factors in here. It's not just the network. It could be the shape of the phone. For example, in the past, we've tested folding phones, flip phones, ones you open, and they seem to do a little better than the rectangular phones that you see now with touch screens. And the theory there is that the microphone and speaker are much closer to your mouth and ear.
So with the understanding that the best you get for listening quality on a cell phone is good, not
right.
Very good or excellent, what are some good cell phones for voice quality?
For AT&T, we recommend, it's been around a while, the Moto Tundra, $180. These phones were very good voice quality for talking and good for listening, which is about as good as you can get. From Sprint, the Instinct HD, it's $250. It's a little pricey, but there's also the Samsung Exclaim. For Verizon, we have the Samsung Alias 2 for $50, and the LG VX8360. That's a regular phone, a regular flip phone, for only $40. Again, very good voice quality for talking, good for listening.
But the best of all of those models you've recommended, nobody did better than good for listening.
Nobody.
Nobody.
That's correct. And they're really steering voice callers to prepaid plans. That's where the simpler flip phones are. And that's where the more affordable plans are. It seems that the carriers are clearly focused on going for the feature phones because that's where the money is. I mean, if you want anything to do with the web, that's another $30 a month guaranteed. Keyboard, probably you want to do text messaging, another $20 a month for unlimited messaging. They don't get anything for voice quality, so as long as people aren't complaining, you know, as long as people can say, all right, it works. And you're seeing some plans now that are text only.
Well, Michael Gikas, Senior Electronics Editor at Consumer Reports, thanks for talking with us about your ratings of cell phones, particularly when it comes to voice quality.
Thank you, Robert.
As airline passengers pinch their travel pennies, more are hitching rides or taking public transport to catch their flights. That's hitting airports right where it hurts. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
More air travelers are acting like Mandy Walden.
Will you call me when you're out front, please?
Walden's boyfriend dropped her off last week for her flight out of the Nashville airport. Now she's waiting somewhat impatiently for her ride home.
I wish I had my own car parked somewhere in the parking lot, because I wouldn't be standing here in these high heels.
But she says the slight delay is worth the $50 she'll save not parking her car. At the baggage carousel, Stephanie Cook says flying with a family of four is expensive as it is.
We have to pay for the luggage also, so anywhere we can cut back, we try to do that.
But where travelers are choosing to cut back is causing trouble for mid-size airports, from Raleigh-Durham to Jacksonville, Florida. Parking is their largest source of revenue.
There seems to be a paradigm shift taking place.
Raul Regalado is CEO of Nashville International Airport, where parking has dropped 16%. To be more competitive, the airport is now matching coupons to off-site parking lots. If that doesn't fill the spaces, Regalado says the airport could start charging airlines more, which would ultimately be passed on.
If this is a long-term situation, it could have a negative impact on the service provided to the community.
Empty parking lots, Regalado says, could lead to higher ticket prices and fewer flights. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Writer Aravind Adiga is the author of White Tiger. His darkly comic debut novel won the Man Booker Prize in 2008. When we asked him to recommend a book for our series You Must Read This, he picked a book published almost 70 years earlier.
Every so often you come across a book of nonfiction that is more gripping in its plot and richer in its understanding of human beings than 1,000 novels put together. One such book is Edmund Wilson's To the Finland Station. To the Finland Station, which was published in 1940, is called a classic and is described as a history of socialism. For these two reasons, I avoided it for years, assuming that it would be stupendously boring. What a mistake that turned out to be. This book is an intellectual thriller, a cliffhanger set in an underground world of revolutionaries and hunted men. It tells the story of a group of scholars on a quest for forbidden knowledge, a secret embedded in human history. From the time of the Enlightenment, Wilson tells us, some radical thinkers became convinced that human beings, and not divine providence, shaped their own history. If you studied history, the rise and fall of kingdoms and the expansion and contraction of economies, you would find that behind the apparent chaos, there was a meaning written out in code. And if this secret pattern, this Kabbalah, were deciphered, it would tell you how to construct a new society, one that was based on justice, equality, and freedom. To the Finland Station is the story of the men who tried to break the code in human history. Men like the Italian philosopher Giambattista Vico, the French historian Jules Michelet, the Russian nihilist Mikhail Bakunin, and above all, it is the story of Karl Marx, the founder of communism. In some ways, To the Finland Station reminds me of Dostoevsky's novel The Possessed, which is also the story of a group of revolutionaries who want to create a better society. Like Dostoevsky, Wilson has a real gift for physical descriptions, vivid anecdotes, and drama, and he brings this group of eccentric, persecuted, visionary men to life so vividly. You are made to admire their compassion for the poor, to cringe at their fanaticism, and to wonder at their perseverance in the face of poverty, persecution, and exile. You do not have to be sympathetic to socialism, as Edmund Wilson was, to fall in love with this book. To the Finland Station is, ultimately, a celebration of the power of ideas. I find in this book a sense of religious awe at the mystery of human ideas, how a strange, compelling thought is born in the secrecy of libraries to an eccentric, how it survives persecution and scorn, and how, at the unlikeliest of moments, it can seize the entire world and reshape it, for better or for worse.
That's author Aravind Adiga. His pick for You Must Read This is To the Finland Station by Edmund Wilson. For end-of-the-year book lists and more recommendations, you can go to npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Hospitals throw away millions of dollars every year in the form of unused supplies. Well, Josie Huang of Maine Public Radio reports on how healthcare workers are finding a new home for those supplies overseas.
Elizabeth McClellan has been a nurse for more than 30 years, and she still can't get over how many perfectly good items hospitals throw out. So she and other nurses in Portland, Maine, go around to nearby hospitals, bagging up supplies to give to health clinics in developing countries.
I think there's a light switch over here somewhere.
McClellan is storing hundreds of bags in her home. They're in her dining room, the hallway, the cellar, and they're stuffed with supplies, most of it in original packaging.
Sterile syringes, diabetic syringes, insulin syringes, gloves, alcohol swabs, everything you could possibly imagine.
McClellan says hospitals ditch items that were once in a patient's room because of strict rules about infection control. Hospitals also get rid of items that never even left the supply cabinet, like these catheter kits she's collected.
And they were going to throw it all away. Probably about $5,000 worth of supplies were going to be thrown away in the trash.
There's a reason for that, says Don Hancock, a vice president for Premier, a company that negotiates bulk purchases for hospitals. He says supplies become outmoded before hospitals get a chance to use them.
Maybe you have invested in some inventory with a physician who no longer is with you, or maybe there is a new procedure that came out that could supersede an old procedure and you no longer need the supplies for that old procedure.
Dr. William Rosenblatt of the Yale School of Medicine has studied why so many supplies go unused. Surgeons order up enough drapes, sutures, and gloves for worst-case scenarios. But Rosenblatt says there are always leftover items, up to $100 worth per surgery. He doubts patients would have it any other way.
If I was a patient in the operating room, I would want to know that the surgeon has immediately available not just what is going to be needed for my procedure, but also materials that are there just in case.
In the early 1990s, Rosenblatt formed one of the first medical supply recovery programs in the country, known as Remedy. Dozens of groups have cropped up since. Occupational therapist Danielle Bouton leads a group called AFIA. It ships supplies to Africa.
An unopened pack of sutures is far more preferable to dipping gauze in alcohol, pulling the string out, and turning it into sutures, which is the strategy that is employed in many developing nations when they don't have sutures to use.
Back in Maine, volunteers move bags of supplies out of Elizabeth McClellan's house to her driveway, where they're being measured by the pound on a giant scale.
35. 24.
The final tally is about 10,000 pounds of supplies that will end up in countries such as Haiti and Cambodia. There's the potential for McClellan and others to collect much more. It's estimated that just 10% of hospitals around the country have arrangements to donate unused supplies. For NPR News, I'm Josie Huang in Portland, Maine.
This final week of the year on Morning Edition, we've been exploring American lives. Yesterday, we heard about a business tycoon who often used his fists. Biographer Will Haygood is just old enough to recall our next subject, Sugar Ray Robinson, who lived by his fists.
I had an uncle who boxed in Columbus, Ohio, and he would watch the Pabst Blue Ribbon fights on Friday nights.
What do you have?
Well, you're back with us here at Chicago Stadium for round number 10 of the 15.
I'd be in the kitchen or something or eating, and there were echoes. Sugar Ray Robinson throws a left.
The winner by a technical knockout.
Sugar Ray Robinson throws a knockout punch. He's down. He's down.
And the new world middleweight boxing champion, Sugar Ray Robinson.
Will Haygood wrote the new book, Sweet Thunder, about Sugar Ray. That's Sugar Ray Robinson, not Sugar Ray Leonard, a later boxer who borrowed his nickname. This Sugar Ray hit his peak in the 1940s and 50s. He slugged it out in the ring and then left the arena in elegant suits, setting a style to which others aspired.
He was the first boxer to take dance and culture and music into the ring. He was the first boxer to really fight the mob, to retain ownership of his fight rights. You know, he owned a nightclub, which was a really good rebuke to the segregationist nightclubs in New York. Robinson said, all right, if my friends Lena Horne and Langston Hughes and Miles Davis and Duke Ellington and Billy Eckstein are not feeling welcome downtown, I'll build a swing club for them uptown and everybody can come.
What do you mean by wanting to take dance and culture into the ring with him, into this? Because he's doing a very brutal sport here.
Yeah, it was. But I think he felt he was writing music in his own mind. I think he wanted to bring a new audience to the fight game. I think he wanted people not just to come and say, knock him out, make him bleed. You know, it's you against Jake LaMotta. It's black against white. I think he wanted people to think about this sport on a higher frequency instead of the lower frequencies.
Mm. I'm glad you mentioned Jake LaMotta, because I want to focus on an incredible series of fights that you describe between Sugar Ray Robinson and Jake LaMotta. You've described Robinson as a stylist, virtually a dancer in the ring. What kind of fighter was Jake LaMotta, whom he faced off against six times?
Very blunt, very, very direct, brutish, and he really fought to eat. He really fought to survive the mean streets of New York City. Sugar Ray Robinson wanted to look elegant in the ring, wanted to look beautiful in between rounds. If his marceled, greased back hair flew out of place, he had a valet to fix it for him.
That was one of the guys in his corner, was the hair man.
You know, he traveled with an entourage, and Jake LaMotta hated that. Everything that Sugar Ray Robinson represented, Jake LaMotta hated. Everything that Jake LaMotta represented, Sugar Ray Robinson found crude.
One's Italian, one's African-American.
Right.
Each of them in a different way has a bit of a chip on his shoulder.
Yes.
Comes from a group that was discriminated against in different ways.
Right.
Talk me through two of the key moments in this six-fight rivalry. One of them is the second fight. Mm-hmm. When Jake LaMotta throws one amazingly dramatic punch at Sugar Ray Robinson, what happened?
Sugar Ray was coming up out of a crouch. Jake LaMotta saw an opening, Sugar Ray's chin, and he threw every inch, every muscle, every pound of extra weight and power into Sugar Ray Robinson and knocked him clean out of the ring, which was, you know, a pretty amazing thing to do.
You have a photograph in here.
Yes.
Of Robinson almost doubled over like a jackknife, going between two of the ropes.
Yes.
It looks like the kind of thing you would only see created in a movie by a stuntman or something.
You're right. I mean, the force was just that powerful. It was a scary moment for Sugar Ray Robinson. He had never been knocked down in his career, let alone knocked out of the ring. So with something like that happening, it was inevitable that Sugar Ray Robinson would tell his corner man, I have to get him back. I have to avenge this. I cannot let Jake LaMotta walk this earth thinking he's a better fighter than me.
They fought several more times.
Right.
And the final climactic fight came in 1951.
Yes.
Jake LaMotta, in his corner, believes he can whip anybody in the world, and he's trying to prove it tonight. He is set, as you can see, to make an all-out effort to retain that heralded crown.
The fight was so physical. By the fourth round, both fighters were bleeding.
LaMotta's nose bleed again. However, Sugar Ray isn't unmarked either. He's bleeding from the mouth.
By the sixth round, you could hear the grunts from each fighter. It was almost a fight to the death. It was also the first of their fights that was nationally televised. And many people sat in their living rooms and they were aghast at the amount of blood dripping onto their silk trunks, at the amount of blood flying onto the referee.
Robinson seems to be wondering just how much punishment this LaMotta can absorb without hitting the canvas.
These are clean, whistling shots, lefts and rights. How he can survive them, nobody knows. Head shake at the ringside.
Robinson won. Robinson showed that a style and fleetness of foot could win over power and muscle.
And in the 13th round, the hard luck round, the championship of the world has changed hands.
Jake LaMotta did not have a happy life after boxing or after that defeat. The life that a lot of boxers seem to have. It's hard to transcend the sport. It's hard to move beyond it. Sugar Ray Robinson, though, you say that he aspired to transcend boxing, to go beyond it. Did he succeed?
Yes. He was a black man during an era of segregation. Where else could he have made $25,000 in one night, one fight? I think he wished he would have been Billy Eckstine or Duke Ellington. I think he wished...
He'd been a jazz musician.
Yes, jazz musician. He loved the freedom of the jazz cats. And I don't think he realized how much of a giant he was to them.
Will Haygood is author of Sweet Thunder, The Life and Times of Sugar Ray Robinson. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me so much.
American Lives on Morning Edition. You can see that amazing photo of Sugar Ray Robinson being smacked through the ropes and other photos at NPR.org. This is NPR News. Anybody who's seen a football game, of which there are many on TV this time of year, knows that pain is a fact of life for pro football players. For some, the suffering does not end at retirement. Here's commentator Frank DeFord.
Dave Pair was an outstanding defensive lineman who played in a Pro Bowl and on a Super Bowl winning team. When I was chatting with him in his living room a year ago, suddenly he thrust out one of his huge hands, grasping the back of my neck, squeezing hard. The pain I felt was excruciating. My hand shot up in desperation to try and release his grip. And then just as quickly, he let go of me. Hurt, he asked rhetorically. I nodded ruefully. Well, he said, sometimes without medication. That's how much I've hurt all day long. Dave Pair took and administered hundreds of hits. Effectively, he played some with what might have even been a broken neck. That's what football players are supposed to do. Play hurt, go back in the game. And because of that, so many of them, like Pair, have spent years debilitated in pain. Only now, at last, are the people in the sport beginning to acknowledge what has been obvious. Football is a gladiator entertainment. Indeed, let us give credit to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Yes, it took him long enough, but in the past month, he has finally begun to take the league out of the same kind of denial that baseball suffered so long, vis-a-vis steroids. Goodell has issued new, more stringent rules with regard to concussions and urged former players to will their brains to a study at Boston University, which is seeking to determine how much does the sport scramble many minds. Invariably, however, when any attempts to improve football safety are suggested, a cry goes up that the spoil sports are out to destroy the very essence of the game. Hey, it's supposed to be a cruel sport. And yes, it not only is, but as the players get bigger and faster, the collisions increase in their raw manpower. Don't worry, fans. None of this is going to endanger the spectator sport. Indeed, if anything, football becomes more popular, more vicariously exciting as it becomes more dangerous. No, the greater cultural question is at the American grassroots, whether the new enlightenment, which will include yet another congressional hearing on Monday, will affect the way the sport is viewed for our children. I can remember when educated middle-class parents let their children smoke, and that's simply not accepted today. Will the same sort of people now conclude that they don't want their sons going out for football? Far more boys play football in high school than any other sport, well more than 1 million each autumn. For many Americans, it's a rite of passage for their sons to be on the football team. Nobody says that you learn to be a man playing baseball, say, or basketball, but that's always been a romantic part of the attraction of American football. But as the risk of football injury and long-term disability become more exposed, will many parents decide that it's better for their boys to play a safer but less glamorous sport? What price manly?
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.